Today's text comes from 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 through 13. As you're turning there, if you recall that Paul has just finished a section where he is chiding the Corinthians for their unwillingness to defer from their rights that they've demanded to acquiesce to those who may be weaker and not putting them first. And that by demanding that they get to exercise their rights in things they feel free to do, they are in fact putting themselves before even the gospel. And so Paul showed them how he deferred his rights when he came to them because they were too weak, and why would they not be willing to do anything for the sake of the gospel? But now he takes a turn, and now he begins confronting the strong, the spiritually strong supposedly, for a different reason. Because it's not just that they're exercising their rights. In this case, it was eating meat sacrificed to idols, which Paul said was fine to eat the meat. But they're doing it to kind of show off how much freedom they actually have. And they're doing it actually in idols' temples. Temples to false gods. And Paul now is saying, you're not just actually exercising your freedom in an insensitive, uncaring, selfish way. You've actually, in the name of all your freedom, begun to engage in idolatry itself. By associating so closely with the world and making your point, I'm going to see how close to that I can get, you've actually crossed the line to participating in those things. Even though you're telling yourself, no, they're not real gods, your participation in all the sin that surrounds that is what's tempting you to continue to sin in those ways. And so he gives them a lesson from Old Testament Israel to show them how they should be thinking. So hear now the word of the Lord. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 through 13. For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea and all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now, these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, these things happened to them as an example, but they're written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. The word of the Lord. Kids, I want you all to look up here because this is not just adult time, right? God cares about every kid in here just as much and wants you to know how important his Bible is and what it tells you too. So have you guys ever seen real little kids who are just learning how to walk? And what's something they love to do? They love to climb on things, don't they? And sometimes not very safe things at all, right? They love to climb up on tables maybe, or on chairs and stand. And when you see them climb up, you think, oh no, because their legs are real wobbly. But they're really proud of themselves when they do that, aren't they? You ever seen them climb up and they have a big smile? Look at me. And when an adult, or maybe you had to maybe help a little brother or sister get down, do they like it when you do that? Do they like it when you get them down off what they climbed on? No. Maybe they kick and scream, right? Because they feel real proud of themselves and they climb up. But you have to get them down because why? What might happen if you don't get them down? Right? They could get very hurt, right? So it's loving to help them get down, right? But they don't like it. Well, you know what? The Bible had, I don't know, maybe you heard when I was reading, our verses today said that if people think they're strong or if they can stand, they better be careful because they might fall. What do you think that meant? It wasn't about falling off chairs. You know what it was talking about? And maybe you've had thoughts like this. You can remember. Do you ever think that you're better than other people? Do you ever see another kid being bad and think, man, that kid's terrible. I'm glad I'm not like that. You ever think thoughts like that? I've had thoughts like that. Even as a grown-up, even as a preacher, I make those mistakes and sin like that. That's something a lot of people like to do because sometimes we like to think we're better than other people. But the Bible says that's very wrong. And what the Bible says, it says if you're going to keep thinking like that, that I'm so much better than other people, it says watch out, you're going to fall. It doesn't mean you're going to trip and fall down and hurt your head. It means that God might have to show you just how sinful you really are. And that would be painful. Not like hurting your elbow, but it would hurt in your heart, right? And instead of thinking we're better than other people, we should be saying, God, I'm sorry that I do sin. And thank you that Jesus died for my sins. And so we shouldn't be thinking that we're great. We should be thinking God is great. Because even though we sin, he still sent Jesus to die for us and love us anyway. Isn't that awesome he did that for us? So next time you find yourself thinking, I'm so much better than that kid, let's right away say, God, I'm sorry. And thank you that Jesus died for that sin too. Okay? Can you guys do that? Try to think about those thoughts during this sermon too, okay? All right, thank you for listening. So as Paul shifts gears now, as I said, to addressing another fault of the strong, those who were in the know, those who were the enlightened, those who thought they'd arrived. Again, what they're doing was saying, I am so free in Christ. I'm going to show these weaklings here who are afraid to eat in the idol's temple that I can. And I won't even, they'll see that I am so strong, I can do this and I won't be tainted by it. And that's the way to help them beef up. Instead of being, you know, weak, whimpering Christians, then they'll be strong like me when they see how much freedom I get to exercise. So Paul, again, already chided them for how insensitive that and selfish that was by putting themselves before these people and before the gospel. But now he's saying, you who think you're so strong are actually engaging in serious sin. Sure, eat meat sold at the market, that's fine. If you're at someone's house, they serve you meat. If it's from a temple, whatever, that's fine, eat it. It's true, there aren't any other gods. But there are, he'll tell it in the next part of the chapter, these temples are making sacrifices to demonic forces, okay? And when you are engaging there at the temple, you're lending credence to all that that stands for by being there. Therefore, you are participating in these things. So he's now saying to them, flee from idolatry. That's what next week we'll focus more on. But this week, he's saying, I'm going to give you an example from Israel to show you how dangerously you're acting. And this is a very, very, very important passage for a lot of reasons. But one, it shows us, this is not Paul's main point, but it's a point we need to make to get the full effect of what he's saying. It shows us how we ought to read the Old Testament. One of the most important chapters in all the New Testament to show us how to read the Old. Because we're supposed to see ourselves in Israel's unfolding story. And this passage flat out tells us, these were written down for your instruction as examples. So we're supposed to see, again, a mirror of ourselves in what happens with them. When they are foolishly sinning in a certain way, we're supposed to see the parallel of how do I do the same kind of thing? How do I see God show them that that's wrong? He's showing me the same thing. How does God remind them he's their redeemer? He's showing that to me too. So we shouldn't write off the Old Testament as so many of us do. 3/4 of our Bible, because, well, that's that old weird stuff. I'll just stick to the new. No, with the lenses that the New Testament gives us, the old unfolds amazingly, showing us how much the work of Christ is on every single page, again, for our instruction and our benefit. And so Paul begins saying, and I think there's some irony there. Again, he's talking to the elite. He goes, I don't want you to be ignorant, oh elitists, of what happened to Israel. Or unaware, I guess is the word he uses, but same kind of thing in Greek, but of being ignorant. Brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud, all passed through the sea, were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and the sea, ate the same spiritual food, drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the rock that was Christ. Any eyebrows go up with that? That's a weird passage, right? Oh, we could camp out there for weeks. I won't, but we could. So how does their experience mirroring both ours but also the Corinthians? Well, first, Paul is going to give them a picture of what happened to Israel that simulates what Christ has done for all those who believe. And he says, the weird phrase, they were all baptized into Moses by being under the cloud and passing through the sea. What in the world does it mean to be baptized into Moses? Well, during our first year as a church, it seemed that we came across a lot of pictures of trials by water. We haven't had one in a while, and I'm sure you're probably thrilled because I talked about it all the time, but now we get to talk about it again. So as many of you could recite, in the ancient world, in many different ancient world cultures, one of the ways they would arbitrate cases was by trials by water or trials by fire. And if one of you accused me of stealing from you and there were no witnesses, it's your word against mine. In many different ways, they would say, well, the gods will use water to determine who is innocent or guilty. And if I'm the accused, I would have to either jump into some deep water, or someone would have me try to cross a raging torrent or have to swim across. There are different ways of doing it. And if I was able to make it through okay, then that was the gods using the water to say he's the innocent party. Therefore, you are a false accuser. You're put to death or something like that, and I inherit your entire estate. If I don't make it, you better hope you're a good swimmer. Right? If I don't make it, then that's the gods declaring me to be guilty, and then I'm now dead, and you inherit my estate. And as I use the same joke every time, crazy as it is, at least it cuts down on frivolous lawsuits. There's too much at stake to just sue at the drop of a hat. So, God is not saying that's a legitimate way to arbitrate cases. But he borrows this imagery because the whole ancient world thought this way. And he borrows that kind of imagery in almost every major event in the Old Testament involving water to proclaim very powerful things. So with the flood, here come the judgment waters of God, and all the guilty don't make it. The innocent do, but again, as you hear at every baptism, why? Covered by the ark, covered with the word, Hebrew word for pitch, that's a rare one, given the double meaning of ransom or atonement. That's what kept them safe from the judgment water of God. And what do they inherit? The whole earth. The biggest one, though, is at the Red Sea. And God has said, let my people go. And out come the accusing, just like the accusations of the devil, the Egyptian army saying, no, they may not. They are ours. They do not belong to the king, to Yahweh. And he has just delivered them by mocking every single one of their gods with each plague, with wonderful dramatic irony with each one. But now they get out, and here's the sea. And of course, Israel, by the way, complains. Oh, great. Great job. You just put us out here to get to die. Either we're going to drown, or the army's going to kill us and take us back. Great deliverance. So they are absolutely unworthy. But God finds favor with the one who represents them all, Moses, who stands in front of them with his staff. And because God finds favor with Moses, God credits that favor to all those Moses represents. Represents, yes. And because Moses represents them, God then says that my judgment will not touch you. And in that, they are baptized into Moses. The cloud, God's presence there, kept the Egyptians at bay. A cloud of fire was, again, it's always a pillar of fire. In the daytime, you see the smoke more, so it's cloud by day. And at night, you see the fire, but it's always fire. The fire keeps the Egyptians at bay. They're under the cloud, and then they pass through the sea. God couldn't be declaring them more innocent. They aren't even wet. There's not a drop of water on them. That's how powerful this trial by water is, declaring them to be innocent because of the one who represents them. And the moment they are across, the accusers try their hand. And what does God do with the water? Declares them to be guilty, wipes them out. And what did Israel inherit in the process? They walked out having plundered the Egyptians, the Bible says, because the Egyptians had given them their gold and their jewelry and their finest clothes. In the ancient world, that is an exclamation mark on a trial by water of all trials by water. So what Paul is saying here, is making a picture, he's saying, don't miss out what happened. Why were they able to pass through? Not because of what they did, because of their representative. They were weak, full of fear, lacking faith, but their representative was strong. And the Bible has uses Moses as a picture of Christ all the time. Please don't think Moses was sinless. By comparison, he was doing a lot better than the rest of them. But it's a picture of the one who would do that for all of us one day. So they are baptized into Moses, meaning they're represented by Moses. And what was the picture of that? The cloud, often associated with the Spirit of God and his presence. And the sea, which is exactly what baptism is described as for us. What? The Spirit and water. That's how we are baptized. But then he says, so they all, he's going to emphasize all. We're going to get to why for a reason. He says, don't be ignorant, Corinthians. All of them were baptized into Moses and escaped. And then all of them, he says, drank the same spiritual food and drank the same, ate the same, sorry, we don't drink food, do we? Ate the same spiritual food, drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the rock that followed them, which was Christ. If you wonder what it means that the rock followed them, we're not going to talk about it today, but that's an interesting one. I will admit. But what he's saying is, the same Christ who you know now was the one back then. Nothing different. And he's giving now a picture. He gave them a picture of baptism. Now he's giving them a picture of the Lord's Supper. He's not saying it was spiritual food and that it was not material. No, what is he talking about? The bread that came down from heaven. Christ said, you fathers ate manna. That was a picture of me. I'm the true bread that came down from heaven. And then the water from the rock. Numerous times feeding the entire nation. And he got the rock. He says, what's Christ? The living water, as we hear about in John. So saying, Israel experienced something similar to you. They saw this deliverance of God firsthand. They were baptized just like you. They ate the body and blood of Christ. That's his analogy. Like you. Yet, most of them died. Because it says God overthrew them in the wilderness. So, again, please, first of all, see this picture. We are rightly to think of our life as mirrored by Israel's experience. We've all been freed from slavery and death like in Egypt and brought powerfully out by the blood of the spotless lamb and then enabled to, again, go baptized into this by Christ being our representative. The problem is with the Corinthians, as with many of us, and the problem with Israel, once they got out of Egypt, they thought it was time to put their feet up. The great theologian Charles Hodge said, you can just imagine that Israel thought, once they were on the other side of that Red Sea, with the Egyptian army drowning behind them, having carted off all their treasures, that finally we've arrived. Well, you know the rest of that story. It was actually finally going to start getting hard. Why? Because in our life, which mirrors theirs, getting freed from Egypt, did they walk right into the promised land the next day? No. What happens? The old generation rears up and says, we don't trust God's promises to get us there. It's too difficult. There are giants there. And they weren't lying by that. That's true. There were giants there. We'll never be able to beat them. So they weren't in trouble for lying. They were in trouble for thinking that giants could beat God. And so God says, really, you don't think I can do that? You don't think I'm going to keep? Look at all the promises I made to you. Who would have thought I would deliver you from Egypt? That I would feed you every day with food from heaven, for crying out loud. That I would be this pillar of fire guiding you, protecting you all the time. And you see all that. You walked through the sea. You saw all 10 plagues. They happened to the bad guys, not you. You watch what happens to people who oppose me, and now you're going to oppose me? What? Okay, guess what then? Older generation who doubts, you won't enter. But I guarantee your younger generation will. Nothing will keep them out. So don't miss the picture. The difficulty starts once you're free. You don't have a battle against sin before you're a Christian. Yeah, you get caught for things you do wrong and it doesn't feel good. You might get punished. But there's no war against an old nature and a new nature. One desiring to love the Lord and the other saying, no, love yourself. And that's the battle demonstrated by those two generations. The old generation says, no, God can't save. The new generation trusts that he will. The old generation must die before the new can enter. And that's what's going to happen with us. What kept them alive along the way? The bread from heaven and the water from the rock. Don't miss the way we're supposed to think about our life, but also don't miss the warning he's given. These Corinthians, there's going to be two warnings you've got to pay attention to. One, there are those who watch all these things happen, and they don't care. They're hypocrites. And their association with the people of God is not enough to save. Watching it and disregarding it does not give you eternal life. Particularly for those who are a part of the church. Baptized, he says, and taking the Lord's Supper. Taking the sacraments. God gives you so many opportunities to see these things and experience them, you're all the more culpable if you still spit on them and refuse. But the other warning we must pay attention to is whenever we see in our own hearts behavior that reflects this kind of unbelief, when you cringe at the commands of God to do right, and when you turn away from the promises he's given you to love and to save, we must see that those attitudes are personified by this doubting generation that watches God do all these things, is glad to reap the temporary benefits, but won't trust him for the future. So that's why Paul was emphasizing. They all saw it. And he says, and they drank the same spiritual food and drink. They all had equal access to God's blessings. He's not letting the Corinthians think there's elite statuses here. They all had the same access, yet most of them died. Most of them is generous. It's basically Caleb and Joshua are the only of the older generation that make it through. So he says, nevertheless, they were not pleased. And so these took place as examples, this is verse 6, for us to follow that we might not desire evil like they did. Now please don't think Paul's talking about loss of salvation, okay? Please, don't think that. He's not saying, hey, they were all saved like you were, but some of them lost it. Now, we can't go that route, and it's very popular to do it because there are people who say, well, look at the symbolism there. The symbolism is salvation symbolism. See, they're freed from death and slavery from Egypt. Yes, but that was all typological. It was all a picture of what was actually saving. So Hebrews chapter 3, just sit put, I'll read it quickly, tells us they didn't fall because they sinned too much and therefore God rejected them. They didn't lose salvation. They fell because of unbelief. They weren't believers, just flat out. They didn't believe. That's why they fell. Hebrews 3, chapter 3, verse 16. For who were those who heard and yet rebelled? Was it not all those who left Egypt, led by Moses? And with whom was he provoked for 40 years? Was it not those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? So we see that they were unable to enter because of unbelief. Not just sin, but unbelief. So please, when you hear what Paul's warning those, he's warning those who are hypocrites, but he's also warning us who believe to not mirror that kind of behavior. But he's not saying they had salvation and lost it. He's saying there's greater culpability for those who fake it, who just want the convenience of some fellowship now and maybe some nice things said to them and want to maybe feel better about some of the guilt they have, but they never actually want to love and worship the Lord. They never actually want to rest in him because they realize what a sinner they are. Those who have that will have it forever. You can't lose it. But those who are just along for the ride are all the more guilty than those who never got exposure to those things. So the common error, what's the common error that the Israelites faced and that the Corinthians are facing? I think the common error is this thought: my biggest threat lies outside of me. My biggest problems are out here, not in here. So Israel, oh, we're out of Egypt. Looks like it's clear sailing from here on out. Obviously, the worst was yet to come because you see how much of their sin and unbelief is exposed by the circumstances they were in. The Corinthians thought they'd arrived. My biggest problems were copying all of you guys out there. But now that I've arrived at my spiritual plateau, you guys can all copy me. Because I'm good because I'm not like all of you. And Paul's saying, no, Corinthians, the arrogance that is raging inside your heart is a far worse enemy than anything outside you. And I don't know in what ways you and I fall into that, but I know that we do. So often we're the worst things we face are what? Other non-Christians, other Christians, people who are making our lives difficult. Health circumstances that might be very painful. Please don't hear me saying you aren't facing difficult things. People out there, even Christians, can make your lives a living hell. I know that. And I know many of you are going through that. Don't hear me saying, oh, you bunch of babies, grow up. I'm just saying that that is not your worst problem. It feels like it's our worst problem because none of us takes our sin as seriously as we should. I bet there are very few of us, myself included, who are praying for the Lord to deal with the sin in my heart the way I'd be praying for a loved one who's on their deathbed. That's the kind of seriousness our sin should have with us. And because it doesn't feel like our biggest problems are within. But our biggest problems are spiritual. And there is a sense that it's also outside in what the devil brings. I don't discount that. The devil does cause a great deal of doubt, but the doubt doesn't happen out here. He caused it to happen in here. So it's still a battle within, even though all of it doesn't originate from us. So Paul is going to now rehearse a list of things to help the Corinthians realize they are dangerously close to repeating what caused the Israelites to be rejected by God. So he says in verse 7, do not be idolaters as some of them were. For it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. That's a direct reference to what happened at the golden calf. Again, very appropriate reference because he's, first of all, talking about eating and drinking, okay, but with an idolatrous scenario. And here's why it's so appropriate. With the golden calf, who were they worshiping? It says they were trying to have a festival to Yahweh, but on their own terms. This voice on the mount, whenever it speaks, we're scared to death. We're lying on our faces, which is appropriate when God speaks. We'd like something a little more fun, a little more user-friendly. Moses has been up there for who knows how long. I don't know when he's coming back. Aaron, make us gods that brought us out of Egypt. They're not saying false. They're saying we can't see God. His voice terrifies us. Everything's on his terms. That's no fun. Aaron, give us something we can see. Who knows when Moses is coming back down. We want a God that's our kind of on our level, we can see it, it's containable, and then we can do things the way we want. So Aaron's like, all right. Oh, Moses, sorry, out came this calf, is what he says, which is hilarious. So they worshiped Yahweh in a way that Yahweh did not say was okay. And Paul here is saying that's idolatry. You made another God in your image, one you wanted. It's not the real one. I don't care who you call it. Very much like what the Corinthians are doing. I still worship God, but I get to do this stuff my way. And it says they rose to eat and drink and rose up to play. I remember my Hebrew professor in seminary saying, that is some serious censorship. It was a whole lot more evil and immoral than that, most likely. Which again, what's happening? The Corinthians are partaking in immorality because of this association with idol worship. Then in verse 8 he says, we must not indulge in sexual immorality, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. If you recall, that's from Numbers 25, when the people of Moab encouraged them to, first of all, commit great immorality with them, but then, come on, let's enjoy a feast with our gods. It doesn't say that they stopped worshiping Yahweh, just as they also bowed down over here. And God smote thousands of them at that moment. So he shows if there's no casual association with other gods, even if they're not real, it's what you're saying about your own God that he's not all that matters. And again, Paul's building a case. Look what happens. You associate over here, and it's always linked with immorality, even if you think you're strong enough to resist. In verse 9, he says, we must not put Christ to the test, as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents. If you recall, that's the story from Numbers 21, where they had grumbled against God, and God's response was he sent them all these serpents, and they began biting the people, and the people were dying left and right. If you recall what happened, they cried out to God in repentance, asked for help and deliverance, and he told Moses, make a serpent out of bronze and put it up on a pole, and all who look to the serpent will be healed, and they were. And we know what Christ says about that in the book of John. Because as they lift up the serpent, so the Son of Man will be lifted up. Not lifted up in praise, lifted up on a pole, on a cross. And those who look to him will be saved. So it's not just the idea of don't go associate with these things, but when I tell you not to, don't oppose my servants who bring you my word, and don't oppose me. Because they grumbled here, and look what happened. And then in verse 10, he specifically kind of summarizes all of what Israel did here as grumbling. And don't, when you hear grumble, don't hear like, oh man, I'm tired of being out here in the desert. My feet hurt. That is petty complaining, which also is forbidden, okay? But grumbling here is the idea of, I am now opposing God or his servants. It's mutiny more than complaining. It's accusations that say, you promised us a good life. I get to define whether my life is good right now, and I say it's not. So you have defrauded me. You're a liar, God, or your servant's a liar. And so Paul's saying, Corinthians, you're already opposing my apostle Paul, and so you're acting very much like they did. He's telling you to stop this, and you're saying, oh, yeah, well, who cares about what he says? We get to define what we want to do. I don't like what God says through him. So this idea of grumbling summarizes kind of the entire experience of Israel in the desert there that he's telling them to avoid. And he says, guess what happened? Remember what happened with them? He said, they were destroyed by the destroyer. It's an odd phrase, but it's really associated with the angel of death, it's called, who in the Passover was wiping out all those who weren't covered by the blood of a spotless lamb on their door. Don't think for a second that God was employing demonic forces for that. This is God taking life when he sees fit. The wages of sin is death. There's no fair expiration date on people's birth certificates that God's not allowed to violate. God decides when it's time, and he sent his forces, his angels, to do his bidding, and he said it was time for those people. So he's pulling similar language here, and it's an important lesson that Israel forgot. The same destroyer that would wipe out the Egyptians is the same destroyer who wiped out Israelites who opposed God. And they forgot. The only reason they were allowed out of what the destroyer did was because they were covered by the blood of a spotless lamb, not because they were just so good God couldn't bear to bring judgment upon them. So he says, all these things that Israel did, this idolatry they were engaging in, and the way God dealt with it, and the way he continued to even work with people like that who didn't deserve it, and the way he still brought the children of this sinful generation into the promised land, all these things, he says, were written down, again, he repeats himself, for us to be instructed by it. So we see our story and theirs, learning positive things by trusting in the Redeemer when they failed, but also avoiding the errors that they commit. But then he says a very interesting line here, verse 11, this has happened to us, on whom the end of the ages has come. Is that a weird one for you? It does not mean, as some say, that Paul mistakenly thought that Jesus was going to return in the first century and he was wrong, and this is another error in the Bible. That's just silly. What he's saying is it's upon whom the goal of the ages has come. And I know it's hard for you to think about your life in this world this way. But in many ways, this is the climax. Now, of course, when he returns and we experience eternal bliss forever, that's a far greater end, far better place to be. Yes, a great chapter, and that's the ultimate end. But what Paul's saying is all these things in the old were written to set up this current generation, the last age before he returns. The goal of all those things is happening now. The goal being what? That God has became man to bring people to himself, that the church would be the kingdom of God advancing on the world, not with physical weapons like Israel tried to and failed, not because the weapons failed or their enemies were too strong, because they failed. So now God empowers his people not with physical weapons, but with spiritual ones to go forward, bringing his message as ambassadors of the kingdom to the world, and stronghold by stronghold keeps falling as the gospel goes forth. He's saying that was the goal. This battle right now was all those things were written to set us up for. He says, so you guys are it, he's saying. These things were not written to, oh, those are the good old days back then. He goes, no, right now. You think, how could it be? I would have loved to have seen the 10 plagues happen. That was when God was really doing something. And you've heard me repeat this one a lot. And I kind of already did today. That whole generation watched those from box seats, actually treading on the dry land, watching these giant walls of water on either side of them. Every single day, they see God in their camp. Every day, God rains down their food on them. And that generation dies in unbelief. Have you considered how profound that is? If that's, again, see yourself in that. That's a picture of humanity. The louder God turns up his volume, the farther in we thrust our fingers and raise our own voices to drown him out. Because if there's ever a time God upped the ante on his revelation that he gave to them, it was when he came down as man himself. We could see him face to face. And how do we handle that? I'll kill this guy if that's what I have to do to shut him up. So Paul's saying, see yourselves in their story, Corinthians. Don't think that you are so much better than them that you can't fall. Humanity's errors are writ large in the story of Israel, and they're your errors too. They thought the worst problems were the Egyptians or the Moabites or whatever else. It's not them. The Corinthians think they have risen above all these other problems. They're weak, but I'm strong. And Paul says, no, in verse 12, if you think you're strong, if you think you're one who stands, take heed. You're about to fall because there's no worse foundation under you than your own strength. The worst one you could possibly have. And it's not just that God wants you to be meek and humble, though he does, and it's right to be meek and humble. But it's also that your own strength just plain will not work. It can't. And I know no one in here is saying, oh, yes, it can. Tom thinks my own strength won't work. What does he know? I don't think any of you are thinking that. But whenever we approach the situations God calls us to, where certain sins beset us, and we don't approach those with a kind of prayer and clinging to the Lord, realizing we have nothing to brag about in ourselves. And we think we're going to be fine walking into certain circumstances, whether it's people who trigger us or circumstances that trigger us into sinning in ways we keep falling into, whatever it is. The worst thing you're going to do is saying, I got it this time. I got it. And as you heard me say plenty of times, there are times when a certain level of gumption will give you a temporary victory, won't it? And that's sometimes worse, because then you think, aha, now I've got the secret. Now I know how to win. Just try extra hard. And what is so sad is this following verse is so often twisted out of its context to reinforce that way of thinking. Verse 13, no temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. With the temptation, he will always provide a way of escape that you may endure it. So what he's saying is, God is faithful. Don't rely on self. Don't be like the Israelites who thought the problem was outside them. Don't think you're so strong. God is the one faithful in times of temptation. Rely on him. Now, I do have to take a real quick caveat. I know there's a lot of internet backlash against this view. A lot of it even over the top, frankly. So you're probably already aware of this. But just in case you're not, often this verse is taken out of its context in another way. Not to encourage you just gutting it out. Hey, God said it's no temptation will overcome you, so you ought to be strong enough, right? So get to work. God said there's a way out. If you don't find it, it's your fault. This verse is not about gutting it out. We're going to get to what it is in a second, but it's also not, as it's often mishandled, God will never give you anything that you can't handle. I'm sure you've seen, again, the backlash articles about that. Well, backlash for a reason, because that is a lie, okay? The Bible never says God will never give you anything bigger, too big for you to handle, because that's most of our life is too big for us to handle. Many of our tragedies that come our way are far too big for you to handle. And for the Christian, that's one of the reasons why he gives us a church to go through these things together. But also, it's why we must be relying on him in prayer. Please don't think God will never give you anything too big for you to handle. He always will. Not necessarily every day, but life will be full of things you cannot handle on your own. This verse is not saying, well, what's wrong with you? Everyone else can handle these things. No, he's talking about no temptation will be so strong that you can't deal with it. Because, I know often we'll say, well, the devil made me do it. Well, that's not true. But God will most certainly not make you do it. So if we're saying that there are temptations that come our way, that they're so strong, I can't handle it, we're either blaming God or the devil or something. Other people. Temptations are strong. That's why the Bible warns us against them. But you can't blame God. And James 1 is very clear. Again, don't turn there. I'll read. Listen to where James says all this temptation actually really resides. James 1:13, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when by his own evil desire, he is dragged away and enticed. Then, after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. Where is God placing all the blame for his sin? It's right here, inside. That's why it's the worst of our enemies. It's why it's where all the battle must take place. Our greatest problem lies within. So that's why this verse is taken out of its context. If you're trying to make it say, come on, hey, get to work, fight that temptation. God said, none will be too strong for you. It's the exact opposite meaning you should take. He's trying to say, no, don't think you're so strong. God is faithful. He's the one who delivers you from these things. He will never subject you to something that's beyond your ability to resist. But don't think the power is coming from you. That's why Paul has to remind all these people. These people think they do have the power to resist these things. I can eat in an idol's temple and I won't be enticed by any of this sin surrounding him. Paul's saying you already have been enticed by it. And remember, what was the whole context for this discussion? What was the whole context for what Paul began helping the Corinthians to see? It wasn't about, hey, be strong. It was, guys, do you see what Israel chose to reject, chose to forget, chose to not focus on? All these mighty acts of salvation God did for them, and they chose to go back to what they want and what they demand and approach God on their terms because they thought they were so strong. They thought they were so important they could just approach God on their own terms, how they want, and they ignored that he delivered them here and here and here and here, though they didn't deserve it, and he kept delivering them. And so what is this way of escape that Paul's talking about? How does God deliver us from temptation? It's by remembering that he is faithful. Faithful to what? All these things that Paul already described. He's saying, Israel, if you remembered, Old Testament Israel, if you'd remembered who you were, those who were helpless slaves that God delivered, and not just slaves, not just victims, you were also perpetrators. You forgot that part. That's why you had to be delivered by the blood of a spotless lamb. You didn't pass through that sea because you were so strong. You needed a representative to do it. You were baptized into someone else. You didn't get through the desert by your own strength. God gave you Christ, a picture of Christ. He fed you the whole way. He got you through. If we are those people who remember that we are those who only have hope because he delivered me from my certain and justified death at his hand because of my sin by the blood of a spotless lamb. If I remember over and over again that I cannot choose to walk in on my own strength because I am one so weak, I had to be hand-fed by Christ. If I remember those things, then I am quickly running to rest in him, clinging to him because I know I don't have what it takes. And in moments of temptation, if I am so overwhelmed by how much love he's shown me, that points my heart in a direction that says, well, then how can I glorify you instead of entitling self? The Corinthians saying, no, I deserve, I've arrived. I'm going to entitle self. Paul's saying, that's what the Israelites did. God never could do enough for them because they thought they deserved so much more. And they complained and grumbled and opposed them in every turn. Don't make that error. Be one who realizes you're so weak that when you cling to him, then you are strong because you have his strength coursing through your veins, not your own arrogance. When we remember these things, we are those who look to the one who was lifted up for us instead of grumbling against him. And we realize, I am going to die like these Israelites, bitten by these serpents that I brought upon myself if I don't look to the one who was lifted up in my place and find my hope there. Look to my Passover lamb who took the death I deserve in my place to give me new life and hope. That is the way of escape. Constant meditation on Christ. And in moments of temptation, clinging to that gospel, saying, Lord, help me feel who I am now, one who's been redeemed by you, by Christ, and let me love what those redeemed by Christ should love, you and what glorifies you and not self.